Welcome back to another exciting edition of the Pointless Exercise Podcast. It's time to remember this crap. Is it this? Some? I don't know. It's remember some. And remember blank crap with me, yours truly, Andy, and Mike Donahue. Mike, how are you doing?
Doing good, Andy. How are you?
Good.
All right.
You can find me at... Oh, here. Here's a little programming note for the fans at home. I spent yesterday tearing my hair out because the Decipio.com, which people probably only go to now to click on the podcast, because everything else is on PointlessExercise.com, just to confuse people, was not working on my phone. It was all weird, and I kept trying to fix it, and I called the people at the host, and they were like, oh, it looks fine. I'm like, oh, you're stoned. It looks terrible. It turns out that only if you have upgraded your iPhone to the new operating system is it screwed up. And nobody knows how to fix it. So if it's screwed up, congratulations, you're like me, you upgraded your phone. It'll still work. It just looks weird.
So you're saying I do need to upgrade my phone?
Well, if you want Decipio to look weird.
To look weird. Okay, otherwise leave it be. Okay, then I'll just...
Yeah, I would think that Apple is going to be like, why aren't people downloading the new operating system? And I said, well, because Decipio doesn't look right on it.
Right. It's pretty much just a cascading effect.
Yes.
And they better recognize that.
So anyway, that's that. And speaking of phones and other things, Mike, your Twitter handle is at Hugh Cub.
Hugh Cub.
Yes. And mine is Decipio.com, all spelled out. Actually, I forget who has the Twitter handle, but there's some kind of like sociology professor in California named Louis Decipio.
Yes.
And he must not like me at all because I get a lot of Google alerts for him. And he probably doesn't get a lot for me. But
this goes back since I first stumbled across Decipio 17 years ago. And I kind of remember sometimes when I'd be looking for it that this poor professor, that was his last name, was Decipio?
Yeah.
The man's last name was the Latin to make a fool's out of
make an ass of oneself. That's why Decipio is Decipio. And that was all because I wanted to call it Balls. That's what I was going to call it. I thought it was a great name. Greg Nettles had already used it for a terrible autobiography. But I wanted to call it Balls. Somebody owned it and wanted to sell it to me for $20,000.
Wow.
That might as well have been, now it might as well be $1 billion. In 1997 or whatever, that might as well have been $1 trillion to me. So I had to think of something else. And I managed to think of something that people couldn't remember and couldn't spell. So it was genius.
Curiosity would compel me who purchased Balls, but I really don't think I should look that up.
Yeah, I don't. At the time, it wasn't pornographic. It might be now.
Well, that's like.
And it might have just been parked. Even I don't think, you know, people would just squat on names,
right,
and then try to sell them.
I remember like early in Web 2.0 or whatever, like let's say between around the early aughts, let's say, kind of when I discovered Decipio. So it wasn't as dynamic as it is now, but it was very, you know, much more informative than it was in 1995 when it rolled out, and there was people, you know, people were recognizing the value that was coming with. A lot of these website addresses. And I remember reading an article, and one of the examples used was whoever it was that was squatting on SammySosa.com, which I don't think that person ever sold that for whatever price he wanted for Sosa. I think it's still just a bunch of like pop-up ads and whatever. But yeah, that was a thing, you know. It's obviously a lot, the opportunities are a lot thinner now because it's been saturated.
I don't remember. There were sports teams that were slow on the uptake, and enterprising young people bought their URLs. Like, I would have loved to have been savvy enough to have bought Cubs.com and have made those assholes pay up. They probably wouldn't have. I'd probably still just own it, and they'd be, you know.
I don't know. It's all pretty. They ended up, I think, clearing out all the pro sport. If you just type in Raiders.
Yeah, at some point, people must have just said, screw it. It's a part of our brand. We have to pay it. I'm sure people made
think so. So did you say somebody bought balls.com from you, or no, you never, they're offering.
No, I hadn't thought of it until it was someone.
Right.
Already
right. Somebody had already squatted on it. Yeah.
Yeah. But I probably could have come up with a better name than Decipio, but
no, it's good. I like it. It's unique.
It's only 23 years ago. So.
Yeah.
All right. So we're supposed to remember crap. Probably not that crap. This week, very exciting. Now, it's just amazing to me. The Bears are 4-1. I don't know how they do it. Literally, I watch the games and don't know how they do it.
Right.
Now they're facing the red-hot Carolina Panthers, winners of 3 in a row. And I don't remember if it was, I believe it was the Bear podcast where I went on and on about former Bear running back Thomas Davis.
Who might start, right?
Well, that's not his name. It's Mike Davis. Thomas Davis was a linebacker for the Panthers.
Okay.
The guy who famously broke his arm, right, and then had it like sewn up for the Super Bowl or whatever, and they showed that weird thing on it or whatever it was.
Yeah.
So right team, wrong guy.
I listened to that podcast, and I didn't recognize the name, but I just took your word for it because I hadn't been paying as close attention to the Bears. But I do now that you mentioned it, remember Mike Davis. Was he not like the third running back that they signed? Even like usually your third running back is a guy that you just is just walking down the street.
Signed him, and then they released him right before his contract would have been guaranteed.
Okay.
So
okay.
They gave him his – I'm sure they told him, hey, you go be free. Go find a place where you can play more. And he's like, how about just pay me?
Yeah.
I'd rather stay and get paid.
Okay.
Yes, and we don't know yet. I guess they're going to find out tomorrow if Christian McCaffrey is healed up enough to play. I think he should probably take another week off. Why risk it?
It's the prudential move.
Yeah. So it'd be nice if he didn't play.
For his benefit.
Yes, doing copious amounts of research, as always, for this podcast. The thing that struck me is that the Carolina Panthers, born in 1995. So this is their 25th year, probably 26th if you're doing
26, if you start in 95, which they did, them in Jacksonville.
Matt Rhule is their current head coach. Do you know what number coach he is in Panthers history?
I'm going to guess, and just so you know, I appreciate the quote-unquote cursory research that you assuredly do before this. I do absolutely none. Once in a while, I might look up one thing, but otherwise, I like to just shoot from the hip. I was thinking the other day, to begin with, was Dom Capers their first coach, or did he join that? He was their first.
He is, yes. Dom was numero uno.
And he took them to the title game in the second season of their franchise existence.
Yes.
At the same time that Jacksonville also had gone to the title game.
About the time the NFL realized, I think we did the expansion draft wrong. Actually, it wasn't the draft. They gave them the full salary cap. That's what they screwed up.
Okay.
And teams the other pissed. Thing. Because
they were still bad the first year, but not horrible like Tampa Bay Bucks.
7-9. They were 7-9 their first year.
Well, here's what I'll tell you is the Bears actually managed to play both teams in 95 in their first year. They beat them both times, but they squeaked by Jacksonville. Probably had more to do with the hair lip Dave Wannstedt coaching the Bears than any actual competence by Tom Coughlin's Jaguars, but it worked out where the Bears got to play both expansion teams that year, and they were the Jacksonville game at least was not that easy, and then both teams were in that title game. So that's what it was. They had unlimited resources compared to
Everybody else had bad contracts on their cap, and so when you go into free agency, I can't afford this guy or this guy, and the two new teams are like, hey, we got nothing on ours. Come on over. They could overpay guys. I don't know how well they did, but that was always the theory. And then they both drafted good quarterbacks. Kerry Collins.
Did they? Yeah, Kerry Collins. Brunell was not drafted by Jacksonville though, because he was
Green Bay. They had a trade for him. I don't know, he was even there the first year? Because when did they get Steve Berline?
Boy, I can't believe we've talked about Notre Dame in the past, and I don't know if we brought up Berline's name till now. Yeah. I don't know who their quarterback would have been in 95. I know Brunell was their Green Bay's backup in 94.
Wait, Berline was a Panther. He wasn't both, was he?
He was, yeah.
He came a Jag and a Panther? He played for all the Cats?
I don't think he was a Jag. I think you're right. He was a Panther. And Collins was a rookie, I think, in 95, so he might not even have been their starter. They may have started off with Berline and gone off. But back to coaches, so you've got Capers started, and then you have the two coaches that took him to the Super Bowl were associated with the Bears, Ron Rivera and John Fox.
Yep.
George Seifert coached the Panthers, right? Did I dream that, or that happened
he
after
did.
He won two Super Bowls with San Fran?
Yeah. Quite a trend for George. 3 years, he went 8-8, 7-9, 1-15.
I thought he went 1-15. All right, so 26 years. I'm going to say that they are on their eighth coach.
They are on their fifth
coach. Just their fifth. So I named
You named them all. All they've had is Dom Capers, George Seifert, John Fox, Ron Rivera. Actually, Perry Fuel coached a game or two as an interim, but that doesn't count.
Lead singer of Jane's Addiction. Yes. Yep.
And Matt Rule. That's pretty impressive. Now, it helps that Fox was there for fucking ever. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years. Then Rivera, 1, 2, 3.
Yeah, Chico was there for a bit.
9 years. So 18 years of just two coaches.
And then I'm surprised Capers wasn't there longer, considering it took him to the title game early on. But
the only coach, Capers was only there 4 years. The only coach, other than Rule, who didn't take them at least to an NFC championship game was George Seifert.
Really?
Yep. Dom, Fox, and Rivera all did. In fact, Fox and Rivera even won the NFC title game.
Right. Okay. So I'm wondering now, and we could figure this out without looking it up, but since that in that time, the Bears have had Wanstedt, Geron, Lovey Smith, Tressman, Fox, and so the Bears are already on six, and they, you know, they were not a bad team in '95, at least on paper.
Yeah, and that's with Lovey for 10 years.
Yeah, 8-9, I think, but yeah. So for one third of those were Lovey, but of course you're talking about a team that has made two trips to the title game. Panthers have been to quite a bit more. So there you go. We've seen another team join the league in our lifetime that has had a better run than our beloved. I guess we should be used to it by now.
Now, the one thing the Bears have going for them is they have never had to take down the statue of an owner for being a racist Hardee's franchisee.
Well, there's a feather in our cap.
Yeah. But in fact, when Jerry Richardson sold the Panthers, he wrote into the contract that they had to leave the statue up.
And okay.
They basically, after this past offseason, said, "Yeah, no, we're taking it down. You're a scum."
Wow. He was actually that insecure about his own legacy that he had to put that in writing?
And the statue is like the Colossus of Rhodes. I mean, it was like this enormous. The Panther part of it was cool. There's like there's Panthers on either side of him. And then he's up there with his football. Now, he was famous. He was former
player. He was the only
player.
NFL owner that had actually been an NFL player, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
It feels like there was another, because like Halas, although he's cheating. He owned the team and played on it.
Jerry Jones did play football at Arkansas, but not in the NFL.
I'm thinking maybe Jerry was like an all-pro. There was another thing that you're right. He was famous for being, because he played for the Colts.
Who did?
Jerry Richardson.
Jerry Richardson? Okay. Yeah, I'm looking at the statue now, and I would have been pretty embarrassed if my likeness.
So I don't know if they left the Cats and just took him down.
Yeah, the Cats do look cool, man.
Just repurpose the Cats. They don't need to. The Cats don't need to pay for
it's kind of funny if you just Google Jerry Richardson statue, you'll see the statue, but then you'll also see some with like the yellow harness taking old Jerry away, because it was obviously newsworthy when they removed it. Wow. Oh.
So while you looked that up, a few things about the Panthers that I remember was that I had a college roommate who for some reason thought John Casey, and he wasn't even kicking for the Panthers at the time, but I was thinking this because he kicked for the Panthers for a long time. He insisted his name was John Casey. And we almost didn't let him keep him in the fantasy draft because he mispronounced his name. In fact, I had another roommate who was a huge hockey fan, and he wanted to have a hockey fantasy draft. And we're all like, we don't know enough about how you'd have a hockey fantasy draft. But he convinced us he wanted to have one. And he was going to make the rule that if you pronounce the player's name wrong, you couldn't get them. And we're like, well, we're not going to get anybody then, because we're not going to pronounce anybody's name right. So it was John Casey. I also had a girlfriend who for some reason thought Kerry Collins' name was Kerry Collins. I never understood that one, but we always called him
Kerry.
Kerry Collins. So we always call them Carry Carry. But then the only, there's really only two games in Panthers Bears history that stand out in my mind. One is recent, just a couple of years ago, when Eddie Jackson became the first player in NFL history to score two defensive touchdowns of more than 75 yards.
And I don't even remember that.
He had a 75-yard interception return for a touchdown and a 76-yard fumble return for a touchdown. What do you think the final score of the game was?
14-12.
Bears won 17-6.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So Eddie Perdue, that was a John Fox special. Well, actually, there's another one. I should say there's three games because we're going to get into this. I still have horrible memories of Steve Smith just running wild all over the Soldier Field turfus.
In a
playoff game. But then there's also the Jimmy Clausen. Was that the Todd Collins?
Jonathan
Quinn.
No, Todd Collins. Todd Collins.
One of the worst games.
Right. Where Collins got picked off five times and the Bears won easily, I think, maybe four times. The only start that Jay Cutler didn't make in the 2010 season. The only other one that I will add that jumps out was, and we're going to talk about the playoff game, I think, just to sort of, you know, for cathartic purposes, I suppose. Earlier in that season, they played the Panthers at home, and it was quite the opposite. I went to this game, and I just remember how stoked I was coming home because it was like the first time since like the 84-85 where we really felt like, holy shit, this team is – you know, they turned a corner because they got off to like a slow start, you remember, in 05. They went 1-3. They had the back-to-back losses to Cincinnati and it's Cleveland on the road. But they sort of caught a little bit of fire. And when they matched up with Carolina at that point was sort of a perennial playoff team. They had, you know, they went to the Super Bowl in 2003, right? I believe so, the Janet Jackson Super Bowl.
Yep.
We're usually pretty much going most of the times. They were established, and they came into Soldier Field, and the Bears just ate them up. I think they dropped Dell home like eight or nine times in that game, or something like that. And they just the defense just it reminded me of the mid '80s, and that not just the mid '80s, but that point between '84 and '85 where you just saw a team just sort of develop. And then they got the rematch in the playoffs, and they didn't even really have a chance to get their footing because the game was sort of almost over before it started, right?
Yes. So the stretch they went on in 05, they won 1, 2, 3. They won eight in a row.
They beat Baltimore at home too, a little bit before Carolina. Yes.
And in that stretch, what did I just say? Eight in a row? In that eight
in a row.
They won 1, 2, 3. Six of those, they allowed 10 or fewer points.
Huh.
They weren't scoring a lot, but they were beating the crap out of people. Yes, they beat the Panthers 13-3.
Yeah, they weren't scoring a lot because Kyle Orton was the quarterback. Not to denigrate him, but it's just they didn't really have a lot of confidence. And why would you with that defense? Tommy Harris had to have been healthy, as was Mike Brown and everything else, right?
Right. So you thought, all right, well, here they go. And
yeah.
So the playoff game starts 55 seconds into the game, it's 7-0. Steve Smith has scored on a 58-yard touchdown pass from the great Jake Delhomme with a John Cassay extra point. John Cassay kicked field goals, two of them, and the Bears are down 13-0. But Adrian Peterson, Adrian Peterson. He made it 13-7 on a 1-yard run. Cassay kicked a field goal right before the half to make it 16-7, but the Bears scored first in the second half.
Yep.
Dez Clark from Rex. And 16-14, you think, all right, here we go. And then it was another 39-yard touchdown pass from Delhomme to Smith.
Yeah.
Jason McKee scored at the beginning of the fourth quarter, and the Bears were only down two.
Yep.
But then the great Chris Mangum. I don't know if he's any relation to John.
John Mangum.
Probably twin brothers. He scored on a touchdown pass. Cassay missed an extra point to leave the Bears kind of in it, down 29-21.
Uh-huh.
To no avail.
Before I get to my own story of watching that game, I do have to say, you mentioned John Mangum. I believe he was the one Bear who played for Mike Ditka, Dave Wannstedt, and Dick Geron.
Wow.
I could be wrong. Well, I'm throwing it out there. Or I'm sorry, Big Cat Williams did too, so I might be wrong. Maybe they both did. Never mind. John Mangum, though, I do remember him. Good number 26.
So if you remember that Steve Smith had a big game, he did. And it might even be bigger than you remember, because I didn't realize it was I knew it was bad.
Over 200 yards?
Yes, 12 catches for 218 wow. yards and 2 touchdowns.
Yeah.
He basically was their entire offense. They ran for 123 yards, but it took him 31 carries to do it. But he was the bulk of it. Much better than Drew Carter, Ricky Prohl, and Brad Hoover.
Ricky Prohl.
Who all caught multiple passes.
Sure. Ricky Prohl, of course, to me, it's one of the most astonishing coincidences that twice he was on the receiving end of a touchdown reception in the Super Bowl by an NFC quarterback that tied the game late in the fourth quarter. And in both instances, Tom Brady and the New England Patriots came down the field with the clock winding down, and Adam Vinatieri hit a Super Bowl winning quarterback. Both times Ricky Prohl caught the tying touchdown. And that was a few years after Ricky Prohl was at the Bears, you'll recall. Mm-hmm. Horrible team in 97. And Wonstead somehow just hated Ricky Prohl because he was like the only guy catching touchdowns for them back then. You can look it up. He had like 5 or 6 touchdowns, but at some point Wonstead just got sick of him and his competence and caught him. Right. Our receivers aren't supposed to score. So
Ricky Prohl, 1997. Started 15 games for the Bears.
Okay.
No, started 10, played 15. He caught 58 passes for 753 yards and 7 touchdowns.
7. And he may have led the team in that.
40
that was
of his 58 catches were for first downs.
Wow. Little Tommy Waddle in him.
And he wore the same number.
87.
Yeah. Well, Wani was a prick. I'm so glad that Wani is on the Bears postgame show on Comcast now.
Oh yeah, he certainly seems to be able to wet his beak in.
Hopefully, I guess I think he does. Like, I think he comes into Chicago just like for the middle of the week to do his shit, and so that may have been why he was on Thursday. And hopefully, he won't be back.
He doesn't live in Chicago.
I don't know, but I think he lines up all of his appearances are like Wednesday, Thursday, maybe Friday, and then he can do whatever. Well, he's got to go to. No, he's not on that anymore, is he? He does. What? He doesn't do the college football thing anymore on Fox, but he does.
Okay.
I think he does some Fox stuff. So I think he goes to L.A. for the weekend.
I wouldn't be surprised if he still has a home in the north suburbs, because I'm pretty sure his kids were.
Mike Matheny was his realtor, and he's still having a hell of a time selling it.
But he basically raised his kids here, and they're Chicago raised, and I think he's kind of here. So
yeah. He's something.
Yeah.
Okay. You know. So the I remember where I was for that playoff game because it was a late game on Sunday.
Uh-huh.
And we had hustled home, my dad and I, from the Cub convention. We used to the first couple of years we went, we stayed for. We'd be there for Friday night. And then we'd stay Saturday, go to the minor league shit Sunday morning, and then make the trek back north.
I want to say the first time you and I met was at the previous year's convention.
Probably.
In
shitty OKs.
Correct.
Yeah. Those were good times. Those were always fun.
Especially in the first few years, for sure.
Got to the point where the first thing we did was we stopped. We just started going home on Saturday. So you know what? There's no reason to stay. Then I got to the point where I would go on Friday, but not go to the convention.
Right, right.
that was smart.
That was. What are you gonna do? Stand in line all hours, just surrounded by people trying to get autographs?
I'm sure that I would have loved to have sat and listened to Mike Quadi go on for.
True.
He could maybe give me a nickname. That would have been cool.
Yeah. Right.
So
you were at the convention, and the game was at Soldier Field. So you probably had
the Eagles stayed in the hotel.
Not the Eagles, the Panthers.
Or the Panthers. The Panthers stayed in the hotel. Or maybe not. Maybe it was the...
A lot of Panthers fans, I'm sure, because Kitty O'Shea...
What year did they lose to the Eagles in the playoffs? Because I think that was
January of 2002.
Okay. When did I go? Yeah. Would that have been the first? That would have been the first year we went.
Okay. Because the next year was the Dusty Baker one.
Yes. Dusty.
And I remember thinking. First convention.
I remember thinking. I mean, I was in the tank for Dusty that first year. Up until.
We all were. We
up
all
until
were.
Like the top of the eighth.
The eighth inning. Right. Bottom of the eighth. Yeah. Top of the eighth.
But I remember him, you know, because it had been. So the first year I went, Don Baylor was there. Is that right?
He would have been in 2000. Yeah, in January of 2002.
I don't have any memory. I don't have memory of that, but I'm sure that's it. Because I remember the Eagles being in. I know it was the Eagles, and I remember that the Eagles were in the hotel too. But yes. So I remember Dad and I saying after Dusty, you know, gave one of his, you know, he's a charismatic dude. I will give him that. No and doubt. He tells, especially when you hear his stories for the first time. And you think, oh, this is great. You don't realize he's going to tell the same ones.
Right. He's got 12 stories.
Yeah. That he's going to tell them for 4 years nonstop. And they all involve batting behind Hank Aaron. Right. I remember thinking, if they can't win with this guy, it's a lost cause. And, well, they kind of did. But,
Yeah.
Anyway.
So did you watch that from, like, the bar at Shitty? Or you are? Was that when you were already pulling up stakes and heading home?
No, we got home. We
it was on Sunday, so you were going home regardless. Yeah.
So we got home to watch.
And it was a late game, so you got home in time.
Yes. And then all excited. Woohoo, what a weekend. And then.
Right. So
nothing.
I was not in Chicago when that game was played. Just a little backstory. My first child, my daughter, was born in February of 06, a month later. So, you know, she lovely, smart, talented 14-year-old today, just started high school. But in January of 2006, my wife was still housing her and was about a month away. And in her infinite grace, gave her blessing for me to make a little road trip out to Denver, Colorado. I had a friend that lived out there, and I went with a couple of other buddies. So it was like a guy's trip, kind of like, you know, blow off some steam before I'm going to be a dad, whatnot. And it just so happened that it was the weekend that the Bears were playing the Panthers. And, you know, you don't know that when you book the flight. You don't know what time it's going to be, whatever. You know, I'm having a good time. We go out there. I went skiing on Saturday, but it was mostly just a sort of a, you know, debauch fest, just a kind of a drink fest and whatever. And Saturday night, you know, we finish up. Wake up on Sunday, and we got to get to the airport. And I got one buddy in the group. I went out there with two other guys, and our friend that lives out there was driving us to the airport. One of our buddies thought, you know, it's a good idea, first of all, to get to the airport early because we wanted to watch some of the game. Our flight was basically going to take over, or going to take off around halftime, so we weren't going to see the whole game, but we wanted to see as much of it as we could. And as we're heading to the airport, one of our friends that had like leftover beers thought it was a good idea to, you know, why not start getting rid of these now on the way to the airport? And, you know, if it was my idea, I would stand up for it. So I'm not trying to throw him under the bus, and we were all willing participants, not that we needed it. But of course, we get to the airport well before the flight because we want to watch the game. And I should also add that when we had flown in from Chicago, here's another. This is kind of an important plot twist, but my driver's license had expired. And this comes in a little bit later. O'Hare, of course, didn't really make much of a deal out of it. And so I didn't think twice about it. And then we get to Denver International Airport. We get there early. When we checked in, we wanted to get to the gate. When I got everything taken care of, she saw that my license was expired. She kind of stamped my ticket and didn't really say anything or whatever. And, you know, it was acknowledged, but didn't think twice about it. Let's get to the bar. Let's watch the game. We've already had a couple car beers, and now we're at the bar. And we watched Steve Smith pants the Bears right off the bat. And it was a frustrating first half. You just recapped it. Bears were down a bit. They showed a little bit of life. But now we got to catch our flight. And, you know, we've got about 3 or 4 hours of drinking at this point. And so we're getting up there. And my issue with the expired license became an issue because they saw my ticket and there was the stamp. And, you know, they start to discuss it with me. And just being Irish and, you know, this is going to be hard to believe, Andy, but once in a while, you know, through the years, you know, I have a few beers. I've been going at it for a few hours. I can maybe get a little sarcastic, you know, perhaps a little belligerent. And And so I was kind of, you know, I was being a little self-righteous and indignant, and, you know, that didn't help my case at all. And then I had to get something out of my backpack. I think it must have been the actual driver's license itself. And as I did, I had forgotten that our friend who had the idea for the car beers had also decided, let's stuff a few cans of beer into the backpacks for the flight home, being frugal and alcoholic at the same time. And it's occurred to me now that we would never have gotten these bags through.
No, not anymore. No.
Right. It's just after 9/11, but, you know, it took a while for it to get really strict. So, yeah, if you have a can of beer in your backpack and you put it through the screener, they're going to flag it. But they didn't then. But it was obviously not a good look when I'm already kind of being a dick and a little bit indignant. And I'm trying to find my wallet and three cans kind of pop out. But he made me go and I had to, like, validate it somehow. And, like, we're getting on the flight. My buddies are getting on the flight. And I had to, like, run, like, through the airport like a fat, white, drunk OJ to do what this guy had to have me do with my ticket. And then I run all the way back, and I'm like, oh, the plane's still here. I'm going to get on. And then he just decided he'd had enough. He said, no, you're not getting on this flight. And that's it. So it's first and only time that I've ever actually been held off of a flight. Wow. Very, very proud moment, just due to my own belligerent an intoxicated attitude. And the thing about it was too, is like, well, you can get on the next flight, you know, you sober up and whatever. And so, you know, normally I'd be like, all right, I can't get on the flight. I'm going to go to the bar and watch the end of the Bears game, you know, but I couldn't because he was watching me. So I had to sort of like, the game was on fortunately at the gate or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it. And so I just kind of sat there looking at a TV screen up above as I slowly got a headache because I was just sitting there, and it was, you know, the Bears didn't look bad. They made a little bit of a comeback, but I kept my peace. The guy let me on the next flight, but that's my experience of the Bears Packers game. Just thought I would share a moment of debauchery from my youth.
You're getting a headache from sobering up and from Rex going 17 of 41 passing.
Was he that bad? Because, you know, I was always a little bit defensive about Rex because I always felt like he got piled on a bit much. It seemed like he had moments in that game where, all right, we're going to get back in it. I had no idea he was
17 of 41 for 192 yards. He only got sacked once.
It tells you how much I was drinking that day then.
Leading receivers for the Bears, some illustrious. Bernard Berrian, 5 for 68.
Was Muhammad on that team?
Hussein Muhammad, yep.
Yeah, he was on that team.
3 for 58. Okay. And Justin Gage, 3 for 28.
Good number 18.
Dez had 2 for 5 and gained a touchdown. Eddie Berlin had a target, didn't catch it. And Gabe Reed also targeted.
82, I want to say. I'm proud to admit I vaguely recall at least the last two names. I recall the others pretty well. Gabe Reed and, wow.
All right, so what is the thing people most remember about Dom Capers?
Is he the guy that Kevin Green tried to kick the hell out of while he was at the Panthers? Do you remember that?
Panthers or the Packers. He brought him to the Packers, too.
It was like the cameras caught it like during a timeout. I don't think it was Dom Capers. It was more of like a lesser-known position coach because Kevin Green wasn't that dumb. But it was with the Panthers, I'm sure. And the coach was like got like that unit sitting on the bench, and he's, you know, being very animated, and Kevin Green just snapped and stood up and like grabbed the coach by the neck and had to get pulled off. So I almost pulled a Latrell.
Kevin Green was no Bryce Pop.
But then who is?
What you I know, remember I about Dom is that it looks like when he was not so much, well, yeah, I guess when he's head coach, but mostly when he was defensive coordinator, and they have that obligatory shot up in the booth, it looked like his hair was attached to the headset. Like it was all one unit. Like it was that little hat, a little fuzzy hat, and he could take it off.
Right.
So I want to play a quick game here of who has better hair. And I came up with sports guys who I think have some of the worst hair ever. And I realized that basketball coaches really dominate this list. And it's because, you know, if you're a baseball player, you got a hat. If you're a football coach, you can wear a hat.
If you wear a hat or visor, yeah.
But if you're a basketball player or a coach, you're pretty well screwed. Because I don't think they're going to let you wear a cap as much as you try.
It's not that NBA coaches are, to a man, like more follically challenged. It's the fact that it's more exposed. They
right. And when you start to lose it, you've got you either have to embrace it. Like nowadays, like you just shave your head. You're like, you know what? It's fine. I'm just going to, the good Lord didn't want me to have hair. I'm just not going to have it.
Yeah,
but there was a time when people didn't do that, and they would go to elaborate methods to mask it, and that's what Dom Capers did. So I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I'm doing a lot of counting on this episode.
Looks are like we keeping this to football or all North American pro sports?
There's only one other football guy on here.
Okay.
The rest are basketball coaches. Because I did this like 30 seconds before.
Is Jeff Van Gundy one of the coaches?
Oh, no, but that's a good one. Cause especially when he was with the Knicks, when he was being dragged around the floor on Marcus Camby's foot. He had a comb over. So better or worse, who has better hair, Dom Capers or the late, recently departed Lou Henson?
Oh, boy. All right. So before you do this, I have to quickly pull up the Google machines because
can't think of Dom?
If he walked up and kicked me in the balls,
just picture a guy with a black Brillo pad.
No, I got it. Holy Jesus. Okay. I got you. All right. Good.
So you got Dom? You got Dom or you got Lou?
The Lou do still. Yeah, my memory was awful.
And the thing about Lou and the next guy is the same thing. So the whole time he coached, he was clinging to this elaborate comb over. He retires. He immediately shaves off the comb over, just goes with the horseshoe. Looks a million times better.
Wow.
The next one, Gene Cady.
Oh, God. Yeah. See, I used to always think that Cady actually, instead of a comb over, it always seemed like he just actually sort of like went to Ace Hardware and bought and like shook up this with that ball inside of the spray can and just sprayed his head.
Right. It was so wet all the time. And so, and not only was it a comb over, but it was a dye job, a terrible dye job.
Yeah,
and if just this is moist
a
all the
if
time.
This is a if this is a bracket, Henson knocks out Capers, but Cady knocks out Henson.
And you know, Gene Cady, to tie this to football, played for the Steelers.
I think I had known that at one point. Yes. I think he used to be a football player. Cady and Jim Finks. All right, go ahead.
So the next guy I think is the closest thing to Dom. I think they actually have the same haircut. Dom's a little frizzier. Former Louisville head coach Denny Crum.
Denny Crum.
Yes.
Interesting.
Denny's very likely was a toupee.
There, I'm looking right now at Dom Capers, and in my mind's eye, my memory of Denny Crum, they almost look like a doppelganger.
Yeah.
They look pretty similar to one another. So at least, if nothing else, after tonight, my takeaway is I won't forget what Dom Capers looks like because, looking at Denny Crum right now, actually, for the 80s, he did a pretty good job. I'm going to have to go Dom Capers having the benefit of more advanced science and still looking like that was shittier than Denny.
Yeah, Crum's. I mean, all these guys would be on restore billboards up and down I-90.
Right.
okay, so we got our lone football guy that I put on the list here because I Google it just to look at it because we rarely saw it, but Mark Trestman's hair.
Oh yeah,
just abominable.
Yeah, it's no wonder he wore the cap, right, as often as he could. But you couldn't hide that at an introductory press conference, and I'm looking at it now. And the thing, wow, holy cow, the very first Google image, it almost like somebody must have Photoshopped this shit. If you just Google Mark Trestman and go to Google Images, and it'll take it to an Argonauts website.
It's CFL-level hair. Is what it is.
Yeah, it's like somebody spray painted orange in the middle of it. It's not like he's wearing a toupee. He's just got not that much hair, and what he does with it. Not that I'm any kind of a freaking fashion guru, but it's pretty damn laughable. So this is why people like me shave our heads.
All right, so the last three guys, all basketball coaches, all decided to eschew the comb over and to go with the perm. Just fluff it up. And actually, one of these guys, I don't think, was losing his hair. He just liked
getting,
the perm.
I'm getting excited about a Stan Albeck reference.
Yes, Stan Albeck is the first one on here. Yes.
Yes.
Stan with the perm with the Bulls was just amazing.
Yes.
He also coached at Bradley. And there's another Bradley coach on here, who the great Dick Versace.
Oh, yeah.
Dick, I don't think, was losing his hair. Dick just liked the perm. Or maybe it was a little thin. But he had mostly hair, but that perm was the worst.
There was like a while where that was almost like a look because the Bulls had, before Stan Albeck was their coach, they had Kevin Lockery.
Yep.
And Lockery had gone silver. Now, he didn't quite have a perm, but he may have. You might want to look. Lockery in general didn't, but he may have when he had the Bulls. So I remember, like, it was almost like they had to hire another coach that had white curly hair, but Elbeck was more gray. The thing about, and most guys like that, it was mostly gray. But the thing about Versace, who was Versace, it was pronounced Versace. He was the Bradley coach, and then pretty much a long time, like, local, like, commentary guy in Chicago.
Yeah, he was good. He was entertaining.
Yeah, but he had – it wasn't gray. It was like pure shock white.
Yes.
And it was actually kind of thorough. It was like a clown almost.
It really looked like he would have fit in like the late 1700s. Like right. It looked like a powdered wig, basically.
He looked like he should be posing for his portrait.
Yeah, like Dick Quincy Adams. That's what he would have fit in better that way.
Oh yeah. I mean, folks, for all the three dozen of you that are listening to this, or I don't know what the numbers are, self-deprecating sort of my default, but just Google image search Dick Versace.
Now, I'll put a picture of Dick on the bottom of the although if you have an iPhone in here on iOS 14, it's going to be all screwed up. But still, yeah, it's amazing. He's a clear winner or loser.
Yeah.
I don't know which way.
It's like
and then when he stopped perming it,
He looked normal. I'm looking at it. It's got the whole range of it.
He had a receding hairline. He had a high forehead, but he had plenty of hair. So it wasn't he wasn't hiding a bald spot. He just liked it poofy.
He was going out of his way to poof it out. I mean, if you look like the it almost looks like a mushroom top. Wow.
So in the same era when Dick was at Indiana, this guy would have been I think maybe he was in Cleveland at the time, but a long time Atlanta Wilkins? Hawks coach. Well, yeah, Lenny, but I'm...
I know you're talking about the Czar of the Telestrator.
Mike Fratello, the Czar of the Telestrator. When he had the perm, it was the most ridiculous thing.
Yeah. Yeah, perms, it's funny. I'm glad you brought this up, Andy, because I do remember thinking as a kid growing up, like as a teenager, that like perms were sort of like we've moved on actually now from comb overs and receding hairlines. But I remember thinking partly because we watched Kevin Lockery and Stan Albeck and then, you know, Versace down in Peoria and Mike Fratello, that like the perm was like sort of the standard hairstyle of the NBA coach. Granted, Pat Riley was the most successful coach at that time.
Well, and it's funny because Fratello went from it was like he was trying to model himself after coaches he idolized. It's like when he had the perm, he was trying to be Hubie Brown. Then when he went to the Cavs,
another one.
He slicked his hair back like he was Riley, and it just didn't work. No matter where.
That's right. Did he go to the Cavs after he was the Atlanta coach, and then he went to the studio, made a lot of money.
Yep.
NBC, and then he went back, and that was with Cleveland that he went back to, or no?
And they played an unwatchable brand of slow basketball.
Was that after he succeeded Lenny Wilkins then?
Yes.
Okay, who so also I think coached the
quite
Hawks.
That's quite the hair, back-to-back.
And Lenny had curly hair for a brother, too. So, like, everybody was rocking the curls. I'm telling you, the NBA, that was the style at the time.
Mike Fratello listed here, 5'7". 150 pounds.
Can you imagine like coaching like how did that work?
Yeah, he coached the Hawks from 83 to 90. Then he was at NBC for until 93. But that would have been the first three Bulls seasons. So he was doing a lot of their games. So we remember that. Went to Cleveland from 93 to 99. Then went back to NBC. Then 04, a short stint with the Grizzlies. And then he's been on NBA TV and TNT stuff. Actually, probably more TNT the second one. It was him and Marv, and they were great together.
I mean, even when Doug Collins was the Bulls coach, he wasn't gray or balding, but he had a perm.
Yeah, Doug had a perm for no apparent reason. He had a perm when he played.
That's true. That's true.
All right, so now that we're really off the rails, we had a couple of my all-time favorites. This is not football related. We're back in the news this week. Our dear Ricky Renteria got the axe. And everyone immediately started to think, well, who are they going to hire? They're going to hire A.J. Hinch? They're going to hire Alex Cora? Which one of the disgraced recently suspended managers they're going to hire. People still think it's going to be AJ Hinch, but our friend, the great Bob Nightingale, swooped in out of nowhere off the top rope with the greatest rumor. It's got to be bullshit, but the greatest rumor ever that Tony La Russa, 76-year-old Tony La Russa, might come back to manage the Chicago White Sox, a team that he left in 1986 when Hawk Harrelson got pissed and fired him for no
apparent. That's right. After forcing him to play Carlton Fisk in left field.
So I did very poorly at this. I always have the advantage when I think of these because I get to do them in private and then I make you do that on the podcast.
Sure.
Famously, Tony La Russa coached three different teams and he coached them. He never took a season off. So from 1979 to 2011,
okay.
He coached either the White Sox, the A's, or the Cardinals.
That's impressive, actually. Over 30 years.
Can you? I got the first three of these wrong, I think. So he came to the Sox in 79. Do you know who he replaced as manager of the White Sox?
Former Cubs shortstop Don Kessinger, who was actually one of the last player managers.
Yes, excellent. So that was good. And then do you know who replaced him in 1986? This one I got right, but I'm not going to count the interim. Doug Cuckoo Rader coached two games.
Okay.
Managed two games. I'm not going to count Doug. This is the permanent replacement. And I did get this right, although
He would have been replaced by a classic red-ass Jim Fregosi.
Jim Fregosi, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. The guy who looked a lot like my dad.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
He used to give dad a hard time. Hey, look, he's a good-looking guy.
Fregosi had been he played for the Pirates, I think, in one of the World Series. He took the Angels in the playoffs in 79. And I think he also coached the Phillies after the Sox. But I remember him being a pretty colorful character. Yes. He was good for a good quote or two.
Yeah. Three guys who looked a lot alike: Mike Dolan, Jim Fregosi, and the dad on the Wonder Years.
Is that right?
Yep.
Okay, yeah. Now I can see
Dan Lurie?
I've met your dad. Right. See, I've met your dad, Andy, but it was when he was in his 60s or 70s.
Yes, the hair was going white. He had jet black hair most of his life.
And so I can't quite place that, but I will vouch for the fact that Jim Fregosi and the dad from the Wonder Years definitely shared a resemblance. Yep. So good call. And now I know that a younger version of your dad looked like them also.
Okay, so here's what I didn't know. I shouldn't say I didn't remember. I didn't know it. So he gets canned in 1986 after he's 26 and 38. So he gets fired before the All-Star break. He goes to the A's that same season.
Okay.
He takes over after the All-Star break with the A's. He goes 45 and 34. Who did he replace with the A's? I got this right, but it was just a blind guess because I was.
How the hell did you get this right? Okay, hold on. Billy Martin had been the A's manager in like 80, 81, 82. By 84,
I felt like this guy managed the A's like nine different times. So I guessed his name and I was right.
Oh my God. I can't believe I'm stumped here. And I'm mad that you've got it. I know like 84 A's, like Dave Kingman reappeared there and was swatting homers as a DH. Canseco came up in 86. Who the hell was their manager before La Russa? I'm going to have to surrender here because it's getting tedious.
Jackie Moore.
Okay. Yeah, I wouldn't have gotten it.
I think if you had me name three A's managers, I would have picked.
What is wrong with you? I don't – like
I
know
would have
it now.
Guessed Dick Williams, yes. Billy Martin, and Jackie Moore. They would have been the only three guys I could have named.
Dick Williams before our time, but we knew he was the manager. We remember him more as the Expos manager. But I remember that name now, but there's no way I would have guessed that.
Well, and so, I know I had a Jackie Moore baseball card as the manager. I remember that.
Yeah,
so that was
kind
of the sweet spot of guys I remembered. He is not the female R&B singer, Jackie Moore. Just to be clear.
No. Yeah.
The immortal singer of This Time, Baby, and Walk Away from Love. It's not that Jackie Moore. Different guy. Okay, so who replaced La Russa in Oakland? This I got wrong because I thought there was somebody in between them. So I'm probably giving.
Okay, so La Russa, I know that La Russa came to the Cardinals in 96. His last year in Oakland would have been 95. And so it's that brief window in time between, what's his name? whoever, Sandy Alderson and Billy Bean, you know, that transition, because Bean came in shortly after. And Oakland was terrible. How the hell am I supposed to know who their manager would have been in 96?
Well, my hint would be that I thought somebody managed before this guy.
You thought somebody managed before him?
I thought there was somebody in between him and Tony, and there wasn't. He managed longer with the A's than I thought he did.
It's not Art Howe,
right?
It
is Art Howe. Art Howe took over in 96, yes.
I would not have guessed that. I would have thought there'd be, same line of thinking as you, that there was somebody in between there, because the A's were pointless at that point. Okay.
So two guys had managed the Cardinals in 95. And I'm embarrassed to say I remembered the second and not the first.
So you remember Mike Jorgensen, but not Joe Torre?
I knew Mike Jorgensen was the guy that La Russa replaced. I forgot Joe Torre was there.
Jorgensen just popped in my head. I remember Torre. I've got a neighbor that I coached our kids the league with that's a Cardinals fan, and you know, we rehashed the Joe Torre, how like Joe Torre was a insignificant manager until he arrived in New York, and he did nothing with the Cardinals in the early 90s. But then I remember Jorgensen replacing him, because I remember Mike Jorgensen as the Mets first baseman from the early 80s. And I'm like, oh, so now he's managing the Cardinals. So it just popped into my head tonight. And so he was the manager before La Russa.
Yeah,
okay.
Torre's pre-Yankee managerial thing was so undistinguished. It'd been the Braves, the Mets, and the Cardinals.
The Mets, they were terrible. The Braves, he did take the playoffs in 82.
That there was the famous cover of the New York Post, back cover of the New York Post, when the Yankees hired him, Clueless Joe.
Wow.
And
see,
Clueless Joe won how many World Series for them? Five.
Well, and it does obviously show the whole dichotomy of talent versus man, like, you know, Casey Stengel in the opposite direction, you know, was wondering aloud in 1962, can anybody play this game? I mean, he was, you know, an epic winning manager for the Yankees, and then loses 120 games. So it just proves the axiom. You're only as good as the talent you have, obviously.
So there are two major league umps. One, I think, is former. I know one's former, and I think one is former. That I know, I know Larry Young
personally.
Yes. Roscoe, okay. Illinois, famous Larry Young. I believe he went to high school in Oregon, Illinois.
I know Oregon.
And I know Marty Foster. I knew Marty Foster when I worked for the Beloit Snappers one year, and he was in the Midwest League, and he married, the daughter of George Spelius, the commissioner of the Midwest League.
Interesting.
And if you've ever seen George Spelius' daughter, you would immediately question Marty's eyesight to the point where you wouldn't make him an umpire.
But not his sort of savvy, because it was probably maybe a good practical move.
Probably. It probably was a good career move, but oof. So I was at we're at one of our friends' houses, and he's a mutual friend of Larry, and we were all hanging out on the deck. And Larry, it was during the baseball season, but Larry, you know, umpires get time off, and Larry had come over to drink beer, and he's telling stories. And and somebody said to him something. Somebody made fun of Joe Torre, and he's like, you know what? He said Joe, he takes a lot of crap for being the manager of a great team and just being along for the ride. And he's like, but that guy is the perfect person for the Yankees. And I don't know if you remember the famous Armando Benitez brawl where
Baltimore.
Yes. Where like 10 guys got kicked out of the game, and it's in the middle of a pennant race, and it's a big game for both teams. And Larry said, we're peeling guys off of each other, and we're standing there trying to figure out who we're going to throw out. And I said, the Yankees, I think they said they kicked out 7 Yankees, I think. He goes, so we go over, I call Joe over, and I'm running down the list. I go, we had to throw Paul O'Neill out. We had to throw Roger Clemens out. He goes, I have just a list of like most of his best players are gone in this really important game. And Joe looks at me and goes, all right. Turns and walks the door. He's like, he thought for sure he's going to just lose his shit. And he's like, all right, we'll figure it out. So that's
nice.
I always think of that story when I think of Joe Torre. It's like, here was this big game, and he lost most of his team, and he had to win it. And he's like, all right, we'll figure it out.
And Torre, he could have put on a show and just...
Or at least just been really pissed that all those guys got thrown out.
And just decided to swallow it. No, I like Torre, you know, and I admired what he did with the Yankees. It just, you know, yeah, he undistinguishes the ultimate description.
The other one of our favorites, who made news this week, Joel Morgan made news for dying. And,
yep.
So I felt like somewhere, either here or on the newsletter, somewhere I had to recount the story behind the single dumbest thing I ever heard him say. And that would be
during
a Sunday night game.
Which, by the way, let's just, for the record,
right,
that is not exactly a simple feat.
Yes. During a, this was late in his run. I looked it up. It's on DeCipio. I'll link to the thing. He lost his Sunday night baseball job in 2010.
Wow, he went that long.
Yes, and I believe that the headline of the article was, "Should we be worried where Joe will end up?" I was already worried that he was going to go to Fox and be, do more games.
He never did turn up anywhere, did
he? No, that was pretty much the end of it. A couple of years earlier than that, in a Cub home Sunday night game, a player on one of the two teams hit a ball into the basket for a home run. Joe figured that was the time to break out his elaborate, historically based tale of the Wrigley Field basket and how when he was a player for the Reds, everybody called it Banks Boulevard.
Right.
Because that's where Ernie hit all his home runs.
Right.
There's a little bit of a problem with that. Ernie retired in 1971. That was the year the basket went up.
Yeah.
Ernie hit 7 home runs at Wrigley Field that year. One of which was his 500th home run, which we know didn't go into the basket because we've seen it a million times. It's the only Ernie highlight we've ever seen.
Correct. Yep, only footage.
So at the very most, he hit 6 of 511 home runs. 512? How many home runs
right.
did Ernie hit?
Well, 512. But, but obviously not
and,
nearly
and
enough. To
I have
forge
a feeling
a,
none of
the
them went in the basket. I have.
Is
I would.
It, yeah.
I would guess Ernie never hit a home run into the basket, which supposedly was called Banks Boulevard because, according to
right.
Joe, he hit all his home runs.
It, of all the apocryphal stories in the history of human beings, I mean, that is one of the most apocryphal and, like, deliberately disingenuous. I was like, where does he get off just coming up with that? I will say, all right, there might be some resentment, you know, maybe about Banks, certainly around Sandberg, about, you know, taking advantage of the power alley, right? Where, you know, look, Wrigley, we, as we all know, down the lines, it's far, but not too many guys hit the ball down the line, but otherwise it's the furthest down the line. But power alley is some of the shortest. So sometimes you catch a good wind, you hit one in the gap, it goes out, fine. But to extrapolate and actually invoke a basket that hadn't even been installed till Ernie Banks was an old-ass 37-year-old who had already clobbered, you know, like you said, already hit over 500 homers. It just makes you wonder about the guy. And it's so disrespectful because, you know, Morgan himself joins the Reds, what, like 72, 73? You know, they had won. They won a pennant in 70. They won it with him in 72. The team was loaded. For a guy that, as good as he was, and he was, I'm not taking anything away from him as a player, but what a fortuitous stroke of events for him. You know, he labors, he toils for like 6-7 seasons, right? He was an undistinguished player early in his career. He led the league in walks in 1965. I'm looking at it now, but I otherwise have it up here. Played for the Colt 45s. Good player, and obviously became a great player in Cincinnati, but he also joined a team that was just loaded with talent all around the field. And the fact that he never demonstrated an ounce of humility or gratitude for his circumstances, I just, you know, says all you need to know about him. And the fact that he would perpetrate a myth about a great player from a previous generation, you know, is not only disrespectful to me, I guess not so much of a previous generation. Morgan debuted in 65, but, you know, Banks was in the league 10 years at that point. So, yeah, I'm going to stand by. He was kind of an older school. So to even denigrate a guy that was not even a contemporary, but kind of a giant from the class of people before him, just it rubs me the wrong way, and I'll leave it at that.
Well, so Joe played the first 2 years of his career in Colt Stadium, which the fences were like 208 feet away from home plate. and I'm going to guess that of his career, he hit 268 homers in his career. I think he hit 200 of them in those first 2 years at Colt Stadium. So they shouldn't count, even though actually he didn't homer either of the 2 years
he played at Colt Stadium. He developed power late in his career.
He didn't hit any home runs until he moved into the frickin' Astrodome. And then he's like, you know what? This place I can hit it out of.
Yes, but Joe even that, was, he struggled to hit homers until he got to Cincinnati, though, for the most part.
Yeah. I mean, the most amazing thing about Joe was he was undeniably a great player. I mean, there's a reason he was the first ballot Hall of Famer. He was absolutely a great player. But when he was an announcer, he didn't value any of the things and other players that made him great.
Right, right.
Like he, like you said, he led the league in walks 1, 2, 3, at least four times. And he had over 100. He had a stretch where he had over 100. 1, 2, 3. I'm counting again. 6 years in a row. He had a string here of six straight years of a 400 or better on base percentage. He was also, especially once, actually when he hit 30, all of a sudden he started to slug.
Yep. Which and, just added
but
to
he
his
would
OPS.
Watch games and he would piss and moan about guys not being aggressive enough, taking too many walks. I mean, he was from the dusty clogging the bases bullshit.
Right, right. Which
it
is
just,
astonishing.
It just drove you crazy because he was. It would be one thing if he had been a player who didn't do any of that stuff and didn't see a value in it. He did it all and he didn't see a value in it. It was just really weird.
It was. It was.
So in 1996-97. I worked for a website in Seattle. It was called GoToNet. It was going to be the biggest thing. We had developed a sports site, and we had a stock. We had a business site that really got a lot of people loved the business site. It had this for the tech at the time that was amazing was our ticker. We had this awesome ticker. It's something I would put on a website today if they had it.
Okay.
And so I went there to write about basketball, but they also had me write a lot about baseball because we just needed it. We spent most of our budget. I say we. I was along for the ride. But they spent most of their budget on. I don't remember who the football expert was at all, but our basketball expert was Bill Russell, one of the greatest Sweet. Basketball players of all time.
Absolutely.
Our baseball expert was Joe Morgan.
Oh.
And we would have been better off if we had hired the old Red Sox manager, Joe Morgan, instead of him. So like Bill, you know, this was the 90s. Bill Russell would do is Bill would write out his columns longhand and fax awesome. Them in.
I love this.
And
that's awesome.
So somebody would go transcribe them, for, you know, retype them for him, edit a little
bit. I'm guessing they were thoughtful.
Yes, they were great.
You know,
I mean, he's a
penetrating.
Yes. He's a very thoughtful, smart guy. I never had to deal with him directly, but they loved him. And when they had, if he had to call Bill or he called in, he could not have been nicer.
That's great.
Joe, you'll be shocked to know, that was not the experience people had with Joe.
Oh, God.
They would have to track Joe down. He wrote a weekly column. They'd have to track him down and call him because he would never call in. And what he would do is he would come up with topics. And just say, well, you just write that up. It's like, well, no, that's not, we want your insight. We don't, you're not, the idea, how about we come up with some topics and you pick one you really like, and then you don't have to write it, but you just, you know, well, somebody will interview you.
Right, we got a ghostwriter.
And then we'll just write it. But that's not how Joe wanted to do it. So Joe would basically be like, should talk about,
almost like instead of providing substance, he was
Nephi Perez, best young player in baseball. Right.
Right. He was like trying to be the producer and like generate the top instead of actually.
He was getting the checks. He didn't want to do any work.
Yeah. That sounds about right.
So that was Joe. So that always colored my opinion of Joe. He spent a long time pissing and moaning about how Ryan Sandberg was overrated to the point where he didn't go to the Hall. He was at every Hall of Fame induction ever.
Is that
sitting
right?
In the front row, yucking it up, didn't go the year Sandberg was there. And so I remember we were watching the induction. Joe's not there. And thinking, all right, he's going to talk about it clearly on the broadcast tonight, on Sunday night. No, he didn't do the Sunday night game. He always took the Hall of Fame weekend off, and he took it off. He just didn't go because he didn't want to be there for Sandberg.
It's so he actually had a free weekend because of Sandberg, and yet still had a dump on him. He would deny that later in his career when he was confronted, but the evidence was pretty there. It wasn't just Sandberg. He always and I'm no Ron Santo fan, as you know, because I thought he was just a horrible broadcaster that annoyed the hell out of me. But Santo should have been a Hall of Famer long before he got inducted. But it always felt like Morgan and Mike Schmidt, like they were part of this thing that kept Santo out. And it struck me as ironic too, because I think, yeah, maybe Joe Morgan was justifiably a first ballot Hall of Famer, but he also always struck me as one of these guys that in a really savvy move, as soon as he retired from baseball, he went right into the media. He wanted to keep his name out there and make sure that people knew who he was. And I think that contributed him to being a first ballot Hall of Famer. And that, to me, he was sort of the antecedent, the first example in baseball of this guy. I mean, it's not true. I'm sure there are examples that predate it, like Ralph Kiner with the Mets. But like he took that sort of blueprint, and I'm going to join the booth. I'm going to, you know, people are going to get sick. You know, I'm going to be ubiquitous. I'm going to get myself in the Hall of Fame as soon as I can. And he did, first ballot. And then Santo, of course, goofy, dumpy Ron Santo tried the same thing and just it got stretched out. But I always kind of felt that Morgan was also a little bit behind that, like, you know, limiting the club and keeping it as exclusive as he could, because that's how he was.
I mean, part of Santo's wait for the Hall was that he was a dick to everybody.
And he wanted it too much. It's part of the thing. You can't.
But I mean, as a player, he was an asshole to other teams.
He rubbed players the wrong way,
which was fine. I mean, it was just part of Ron being Ron. But then, you know, so much of it is political. Eventually, he became famous for being the best player not in the Hall of Fame.
Right.
And at that point, it'd been long ago enough that he. People, the sentiment even among former players started to turn, and it softened, and they weren't actively bitching and pissing and moaning about him.
They still waited till he died, which frankly still kind of makes me laugh because I'm a horrible person. But he still didn't get inducted till after he was gone. I mean, I'm torn because I was always annoyed by the broadcast of Santo, but like by any metric, and I know the one argument was like, how can you let four guys from a team that never won a pennant into the playoffs?
I mean,
I don't know. If
21 other guys aren't good, four great players aren't going to the World Series. So.
For a while, he was just a shade behind Brooks Robinson defensively, and he was an above average. He was actually the best offensive performer on those DeRocher era pennant contenders statistically. Probably a little bit of an edge over Billy Williams, and played a position that's been historically overlooked, and he was great, but his own personality got in the way. So. Yeah. But like I said, I think more guys like Morgan capitalized on that, though, too.
So to kind of bring this, at least the baseball part, full circle, one of the things Joe is most famous for is he shares with another guy we talked about, both he and Hawk Harrelson hated Moneyball, the concept, the book, everything. And the two things
again,
they have in common.
Morgan is supremely ironic because he was the classic quote unquote
Moneyball
player.
Right. You could make a Moneyball case that you could use Moneyball or, you know, like that concept to make a case that he was even better than people.
Bill James has him ranked as the all time greatest second baseman ahead of Hornsby and Charlie Gehringer and Roberto based on sabermetrics. And I think he's got him in the top 10, or maybe not for players, but he's definitely the number one second baseman for Bill James.
But the thing Hawk and Joe have in common is they both hated the book. They talked about it all the time, but neither one of them read it. And they both admitted they never read the book.
Jesus.
But Joe goes one better, because Joe was always convinced, and he would say it, he thought Billy Beane wrote the book. It's like, no, Michael Lewis wrote the book. Billy's in the book. He didn't write the book. And he would bitch about it on Sunday Night Baseball about, you know, that book he wrote. It's like, he didn't write the book.
Yeah. Like between checking on the scouting departments and making deals, he's sitting with his,
sure that Dan Bernstein asked him on the air one time why he decries the book so much, if he'll ever read it. He's like, I'm not going to read it. I know what's in it. It's like, well, no, I don't think you do. Because...
Right.
It seems like you really don't know what.
It's just classic willful ignorance. and I know like younger kids, and I caught some heat from a couple people, but like people grew up with that voice, and I only feel pity for them because that, like, maybe Joe Garagiola was not the greatest color analyst. If like maybe you listened to his games, maybe he spouted the same bromides, you know, had the same anti-intellectual nonsense. I don't know. Maybe that's the case. Maybe I'm just being nostalgic, but I just feel like we benefited more by having Tony Kubek and Joe Garagiola provide color to our youth on national games compared to the kids that came after us and had to get subjected to that arrogant, self-absorbed, whatever. He's dead, so I'm not going to drop any more pejoratives. But Joe Morgan, that was the voice of the youth for a lot of our kids, and I just think that's sad.
Yeah, I don't. It's a shame that, given especially, you know, nowadays Sunday Night Baseball doesn't have the impact that it did. It replaced the NBC Game of the Week as the game.
It was impactful. I'll give it that.
Especially when I wrote for The Athletic, I was always pissed when the Cubs were on it because I wrote a Monday column and I really wanted to have the damn thing done by, like, you know, 7 o'clock at night. I didn't want to have to wait for the game to end in case I had to fix any of it, so I would always bitch. But I also just think the Cubs should always play at 1:20 on Sundays, so I still get pissed.
Right.
I still get pissed when they had to play on the Sunday night
game. And no pajama tops.
Yes, no pajama tops and no, yeah, and don't wear the blues ever. Those things are.
Well, those are the pajama tops, right?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I think of the pullovers as the pajama tops.
Oh, yeah, yeah. All right, my bad.
But regardless, I don't like those things. Joe and Hawk hate Billy Beane for writing a book that he didn't write. Actually, I mean, we know what Hawk's problem with the book was. Michael Lewis going on and on about the... I don't remember which trade it was now. The Sox and A's make a trade in the book.
And Red Sox.
He makes a huge deal out of the fact that that Billy really screwed Kenny over. And Hawk took that. And it didn't turn out that way. I don't remember who the trade was off the top of my head. But it didn't turn out that way. But yeah, Hawk was gleeful whenever here were the A's going to the playoffs every year. You know, the Sox have still never gone to the playoffs in back-to-back years. The A's were going every year, but they weren't winning pennants. And so Hawk somehow would do a victory lap that the Billy Beane shit didn't work. It's like he's getting them to the playoffs every year. Or the other thing was the book's all about on base percentage, and the only reason they're good is because of those pitchers. Well, yeah, he got them too.
You know, right.
It's not like Billy's only picking the hitters.
Mulder, Hudson, and Zito.
He drafted
those three
them all together. Yes.
And developed him. Good point.
So, all right. Well, we started off with Steve Smith running wild on the Bears. We ended up with.
Yep. But you knew we'd have to stretch some time considering we're dealing with an NFL franchise that has such a short history.
25 years.
25 years, and not that much at the Bears, but we stretched it out. I even invoked my own drunken incident at Denver International Airport just to stretch out the Bears-Panthers narrative. So
the Panthers do have a winning all-time winning record in the playoffs.
Okay.
They're 9-8, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, I think most teams are under 500 in the playoffs because that's usually how it works.
Except for maybe the Pats and the Niners.
The Pat only, and I'm only going to say only because the Pats never freaking made the playoffs like that often.
Right, they didn't have a bunch of one and outs because they were.
They never were.
Went to one Super Bowl, then all of a sudden got really good and went to all the Super Bowls for a while.
So. Correct. So. All right. Well, we'll brush up on some Rams stories. I think we can. That'll be the next opponent. There's some stuff there. I think at least more than the Panthers.
All right, well, good. So, nice job, Mike. And
you too.
So, go Bears.
Go Bears. Talk to you in a week.
Many of us have herpes.